This is the Popmatic Podcast for June 29th, 2016. The Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. We are coming to you from Studio NPL in the heart of downtown Nashville. I am Brian, and joining me today are
Jeremy,
Bill,
Mike.
Amanda.
On today's episode, we celebrate the independence of these worthy states of ours, united against the tyranny of Britain. That's right, kids, all things USA, because it is, or will soon be, the 4th of July. Mike!
Brian.
Light my fuse on my firework. Oh, wait, that came out bad, didn't it? That came out bad, didn't it?
I don't know, bro. You could do that at home. Wow. Hail to the chef, gang, because I'm going to cook up some new recommendations. So I guess I could attract my interest in the presidents of the United States to a poster that hung up in the third grade. When my teacher would talk about something uninteresting like math and math and some more math, my attention would wander to a poster that hung a couple of feet to my left. Portraits of every single president from Washington to Reagan. I wonder just who these old white dudes were and what happened during those 1 month to multiple, about a decade terms each of them served. I also credit that poster with my perception of time. But I'm saving that for our special episode on the fourth dimension in 2035 when we send monkeys back to start the 12 monkeys. My interest continued with the book on presidential campaigns, being the first nonfiction book I ever bought for fun. Tune back to the President's episode for that, gang. Through my degree at Poli-Sci, up until today, when I'm planning side trips on my upcoming road trip around the Midwest to see everything from Lincoln's tomb to the Presidential Library of Gerald Ford.
Whoa! You sound like Sarah Vowell. Like Sarah Vowell's going to like follow you around and go on vacation with you now.
That's right.
I had water in my mouth when you said that, and I almost spit it out.
Hey, you know, scenic Grand Rapids, y'all.
Scenic Grand Rapids.
Michigan.
Come see some photos of a guy falling downstairs.
Yeah, I'm curious.
That's your legacy.
I mean, even as a president, he was known for not reading much. So I expect there's like three books or something.
Cool.
Playing football. Not impeaching Nixon.
Pardoning Nixon.
Yeah, pardoning Nixon. Yeah. A disappointing three-year term. Anyway, another interest that I have, which you can hear about every Shocktober, so I won't go into it here, is in the dead. So I was pleased as spiked punch when Dead Presidents, an American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders by Brady Carlson came across my desk. Much like it says, it details the deaths, burial sites, and or interesting afterlife journeys of each of the presidents, and in a most entertaining manner. I do get fooled into checking out books similar to this from time to time, and they do get a bit monotonous. For example, we have a book called Party Like a President on the drugs/booze. That every president indulged in, and the only interesting thing about it is that much like bored teens at the prom, 19th century presidents were really, 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 really into spiked punch.
We all were.
By like the 10th one, I was like, I get it.
Chug! 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 Keg stand.
Dead Presidents is different, though, for one thing, it's not just a list in chronological order. I was so shocked slash pleased that Chapter 2 did not begin with John Adams yet again. You have no idea. Every chapter has a theme, like chapter 2 is on the presidential physician and like how they failed, especially in the case of James Garfield in episode Crepton. And chapter 5 is on the posthumous journeys of a few of the presidents made before actually becoming entombed. The tone is very easy to read, a little irreverent. One bit that really stuck with me is that on the route I walk every single morning from my bus stop up on Charlotte Avenue to the library was the house that James K. Polk died in, called Polk Place, which has now been replaced by the Capitol Hotel. There's a plaque and everything. It's just weird reading it in a book. I actually wrote, this is when I laugh. Reading up on some of the more obscure presidents between Jackson and Lincoln, it kind of makes me want to revisit my early idea of reading a biography of all the presidents. Oh boy. I tried that as a kid and got stuck on Martin Van Buren, who's duller than you can imagine.
They make those, what's that little, they make that little series, these little like pocketbooks, but they're for adults, biographies of every president. If you wanted to speed it, or if you want to be ooh, scholarly.
Pockety.
The short version.
I like the sound of this, especially going through Martin Van Buren.
Do you remember that bit on The Simpsons where they're like, we're the lesser known presidents or whatever, and it's like, I'm something, something. I died in 30 days. it would be funnier if I remembered all the parts of it.
We could spice that in.
We are the mediocre presidents. You won't find our faces on dollars or on cents. There's Taylor, there's Tyler, there's Fillmore, and there's Hayes. There's William Henry Harrison.
I died in 30 days.
A lot of fun. Way different than the thing that Amanda's going to talk about, but she's not anymore. What do you have?
No, I'm still going to talk about it, but it's just that my tickle my fancy. Got to wait for it.
Oh. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
What do you have, Bill?
Well... On the 4th of July, we will be celebrating Independence Day. If fireworks aren't your thing or the great outdoors, then you might want to celebrate the 4th of July with some Neil Simon, whose birthday is on July the 4th. Mr. Simon will be 89 this July 4th. Happy birthday, Neil Simon. It was once said you can depend on three things, death, taxes, and a new Neil Simon play on Broadway. Mr. Simon has not written a play since 2003, but between 1961 and 2003, there was a play on Broadway or a movie he had written on the screen. And I want to recommend three DVD titles that we have. First up, Barefoot in the Park is the play that and movie that put Robert Redford on the map. He stars with Jane Fonda and they play young newlyweds in their adventures in a New York brownstone. Mildred Natwick is hilarious as Jane Fonda's mother. Second is The Odd Couple, which is about two divorced men who share an apartment in New York City. Felix Unger, Jack Lemmon, a neat freak, and Oscar Madison, a slob. The play was based on Neil Simon's brother Danny, who was living with another divorced man. When Neil visited his brother, he noticed that all they did was argue about cooking and cleaning, like a married couple, the inspiration for The Odd Couple. The third was not based on a play, but was an original screenplay called The Goodbye Girl, starring Richard Dreyfuss, Marsha Mason, and Quinn Cummings. Richard Dreyfuss won a well-deserved Oscar for his part as an actor who has sublet an apartment from another actor who is in Europe making a movie. The problem is the actor in Europe left his girlfriend and 10-year-old daughter behind. Hijinks ensue. We also have in our collection two Neil Simon biographies, Rewrites, a memoir, and The Play Goes On, which are two-part biographies about Simon's life and work. Happy 4th of July, and happy birthday, Neil Simon. And Jeremy, you acted in a Neil Simon play, you told me. Do tell.
Why, yes, that's true. I think.
Were you the goodbye girl?
I was going to talk about Murder by Death, but now I want to hear about your... Barefoot in the Park experience.
I was in a play called Fools when I was a junior in high school, and it was like something like this guy travels to it's supposed to be Russia or some sort of Eastern European place, and he goes to this village, and everybody there is dumb because there's then this curse on the, and then he marries some girl, and then everybody like gets smart at the end. Spoiler alert. And I played Snetsky the sheep herder. I was the first person on stage in the production. I walked out with my little crook and I let my hair grow out so I looked nuts. And my first line was Alenia, Lebedev, Marushka, Olga. And then I was looking for my sheep.
Wasn't your character kicked in the head?
My head had been kicked. My character had been kicked in the head by a horse.
That is so cool.
Typecasting.
But yeah.
So many bad jokes about poor Jeremy. It came through my mind this whole bit, but you know.
Thank you for sharing.
You're welcome.
Yes, yes.
Nice setup, too, by the way. That was good.
So what do you have to talk about today that is 4th of July themed?
Oh.
You guys remember the movie Independence Day?
Yeah. Oh, whoa. Yeah, man. The White House blew up. That's so cool. The Day to Die, too. I love that movie. I want to watch it again. I heard a sequel's coming out. Will Smith isn't in it. That sucks. He was a hero.
And scene.
Oh, wow. I didn't know.
Okay.
Brian had the
today on the podcast, ID4 catharsis.
Fan in the chamber.
Wow.
Oh.
No, I've never heard of that movie. What's it about?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I watched it a million times on HBO.
Well, there was a scene in that film.
Had Brent Spiner in it.
Yeah.
Hence the Data Dynamics.
Yeah. I heard Dana. I'm like, no, who's Dana?
Dana Scully. Anywho, in that movie, James Rebhorn's Secretary of Defense gives Bill Pullman's President of the United States a two-word explanation for the president's ignorance about Area 51's activities. And Area 51, as you may know, is like this shrouded in secrecy military base in the Nevada desert. The Secretary of Defense says it's plausible deniability. This concept insulates high-ranking officials from being implicated in scandals involving nefarious government activities like torture, the sale of weapons to rogue nations, or even the existence of aliens. Happy birthday, America. But there's no denying the power of Annie Jacobson's Area 51 and uncensored history of America's top secret military base. It's a fascinating and often chilling look at that little patch of restricted airspace out in the Nevada desert that's launched 1,000 conspiracy theories and a 1995 light gun arcade game. Area 51 has held a place in the popular imagination for decades, so approaching a book about it, which doesn't hold as its central thesis the idea that government scientists are communing with extraterrestrials deep underground, is kind of a downer. But beyond the secret and subterfuge, really what this book is about is about testing experimental airplanes and aircraft which flew reconnaissance missions over the Soviet Union during the Cold War, testing increasingly powerful weapons during the Cold War, and generally trying to one-up the commies during the Cold War. Annie Jacobson reads the audio version of this book, which I downloaded from Overdrive, and really kind of dispenses with all the alien stuff early on. And the book kind of goes into much darker and stranger territory than that. The kind of selling point of the book, I guess, or like the sort of big moment in the book is, according to an anonymous source that she talks to extensively, the alien bodies that were recovered in Roswell, New Mexico, were actually not aliens at all, but were actually children, and they were no older than the age of 12, and they had been deformed by notorious Nazi doctor Joseph Mengele at the behest of Joseph Stalin. And these kids, which were like essentially guinea pigs, human guinea pigs, were sent to the U.S. in an experimental aircraft designed to cause a War of the Worlds-style panic. So let's just let that sink.
It seems a little easy to blame it on the Nazis.
Yeah, wow. I
mean, they're kind of like the national scapegoat.
I have to go to like Weather Blue, Norfolk, you know, well, reflecting off Venus in a swamp or whatever, yeah, in the desert.
There's all kinds of reports. I mean, something happened there, you know, and so this is maybe even stranger than what the accepted conspiracy theory is, you know what I mean? So this claim, anonymous source and all, has been something of a, like an albatross maybe around the spine of this book. It's like people are more inclined to believe alien stuff than stuff about human experimentation, which is more horrible. And there are lots of people from the military, science, and intelligence communities who have said this book is riddled with inaccuracies and mistakes. So maybe, and I'm not one to judge this because I don't know these things, but you know, maybe it's not the most accurate historical account of a top secret installation, because of course there's going to be lots of misinformation out there and tinfoil on my head. But maybe these people are trying to hide something. Maybe they too have an intimate relationship with plausible deniability. So maybe it has an accuracy problem, but so did the light gun game. And writing about top secret subjects is bound to unearth both horrible truths and nuggets of lies. Either way, it really is a compelling book. And sort of a fascinating look at the military-industrial complex. Brian?
Sounds cheery.
When you say military-industrial complex, I think about myself. Lack of segue has shut down the podcast, and I'm just going to make it worse. Nobody by switching things up, instead of talking about something free on the internet during my Tickle My Fancy segment, I'm going to talk about that now, and during my Tickle My Fancy segment, I'm going to talk about something you can get from the library. Did that make sense? But back to the matter at hand. Let's go back in time. Tiddly-doop, 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 tiddly-doop. During our March 23rd, 2016 episode, that you might remember, that is our notorious water closet episode.
Oh, we were in the water closet.
Yes.
I
flushed that from my mind.
I mentioned the board game Liberty or Death with art by Terry Leeds, which deserved a far more respectful reception. Liberty or death concerns the American Revolution, which, as you may know, kicked off on July 4th, 1776. Arguably. Now, if I sparked your interest in this game and you searched for it on the internet, one of the first hits you might have got was a YouTube review of the game on a channel called Marco Wargamer. Now, as you know, America is a nation of immigrants, and one of my favorites... One of my favorites of those immigrants is Dr. Marco Arnotto. Dr. Arnotto administers the Marco Wargamer channel, where he posts video reviews of board games, a lot of them being war games, and he's very good at it. War games are dry, but Dr. Arnotto, is witty and engaging, and he can make very complicated concepts very simple. There's a stereotype about the kind of person that is interested in war gamers. Just kind of imagine, like, Dennis Hastert, you know, but he kind of breaks all those stereotypes. He's a history buff, and he often brings his knowledge of history to his explanations of the game. Sometimes he's willing to go a little deeper and talk about, like, the ethics of games. And for instance, he even sometimes talk about the human toll of war, which is a wargaming taboo. The idea is, if you're going to play, like, a conflict simulation, you just sort of ignore the actual human cost of war. It's just kind of an unwritten rule about wargaming. He's sort of willing to break that taboo. But then he's also willing to make jokes, too. Like, usually in war games, like, sort of clip the fuzzy edges off your cardboard counters, and he doesn't do it, and he'll make fun of the people that do it. He'll be like, "Oh, you big, tough wargamers, you clip your counters," and he doesn't. Things like that. And then even better, he has two young children, so sometimes he reviews kids' games, and it's really great contrast because he's this really insightful, intelligent guy, and sometimes he does really dry, long, complex war games, but then he'll also review, like, "This game's called Mary Bo Peep, and it's for ages 3 to 4, right? And, like, he'll talk about whether his...
She declares war on the spider.
Exactly. He'll talk
to
about...
The
not here, you're not.
He'll talk about whether his daughter...
Kurds plus way equals violence. Yeah.
You know, he's also... YouTube is a visual medium. He's fun to watch. He's like a goofy looking dude. He kind of looks like Gollum, or like your friendly neighborhood Gollum. And it's funny too, because he kind of lets his hair grow out. Kind of like a white boy fro. But then every once in a while, kind of shave it off. You know, it's kind of funny. He is from Italy originally. He has a PhD from the Higher Normal School of Pisa, and then also some other place called Harvard that I never heard of. But he's an Italian professor at the University of Indiana Bloomington.
Woohoo!
Yes.
You.
And his expertise is Baroque and early Italian literature. So 20th and 21st century pop culture, and then board games, obviously, and military simulations. He's also taught classes about spy literature and war games besides his Italian classes at the University of Indiana. And lest you think I'm totally leaving you hanging, Dr. Arnotto has wrote a book about superheroes called The Myth of the Superhero, which, quote, explores the influence of religion and myth on superhero stories, as well as their relationship to classical, epic, and Baroque styles.
He has written a book.
He has written a book. Thank you. Even better, the library owns this book, and you can check it out. Now, the next book
By clicking, you can hear in the distance is Jeremy putting a hold on it.
Now, even better, his next book is going to be about board gaming as interactive fiction, and I am desperately awaiting this title.
I feel like you guys need to go on a road trip to Bloomington.
Now for something.
A little different.
Boy, this is the segment I've been waiting for, guys.
Now for something completely different.
Save the best for last, baby. Save the last for last.
Oh, boy.
Okay, so for me, the 4th of July always means vacation and family. And when I was growing up, my cousins lived about a half an hour away, and we always had to go to their house for birthday parties. But on the 4th of July, everybody came to my house, and we got to go to the carnival, and there were fireworks. So there. So to this day, we all still celebrate together as a family at my mom's house. But now it takes us a few days to kind of recover from the festivities. So my husband and I go on vacation for the rest of that week. Now, one of the things I love to do on vacation, this is going to be shocking, is I love to read. So today I'm going to share with you a great summer read that might in turn make you feel smarter. So I've mentioned before on the podcast that I, A, like the author, Curtis Sittenfeld, and B, I have never read Jane Austen. So I was excited when I found out that Sittenfeld had a new book coming out. I was maybe a little less excited when I found out that it was another modern-day version of Pride and Prejudice. I mean, really? We need another one of those?
Yeah, we did!
Yeah, Pride, Prejudice. Yeah. Pride, Prejudice 2, Pride-ier and Prejudice-ier.
Yeah, they're going to kill Rin's Spider.
This one has no zombies. So here's the thing about Curtis Sittenfeld. Usually I start reading her books and then I get mad at her choices about halfway through. But this time I got mad to start because the author didn't even use new names for the characters. They're still the same names. But luckily I kept reading and it got better. So apparently it was good to kind of get my anger out of the way early. Now, I don't think I need to give you a plot rundown. It's Pride and Prejudice. Hello. But I will say that the new version involves CrossFit, a transgender marriage, and participation in reality TV. So that sounds...
You sold me. I'm there.
I know, right? I've sold you all on this great read. So after I finished reading all 492 pages, which admittedly went quicker than I thought they would, I found out that modernizing Jane Austen is like this whole thing. So apparently someone came up with the idea for six modern authors to each rewrite and release one of Jane Austen's six completed works. So Sittenfeld's Eligible is number four, and the first three are Sense and Sensibility, which was rewritten by Joanna Trollope, Northanger Abbey, which came out by Val McDermid, and then Emma by Alexander McCall Smith. So this vacation you can read fun beach reads, but still tell people that you are reading classic literature, and they'll think you're really smart. And I don't think you have to read the originals to enjoy these because, you know, I didn't. Now, as I'm, you know, talking about this, I'm realizing I'm recommending a British author for to celebrate America's birthday. But we were enemies 250 years ago, so now we can all be friends. Yeah. So it's nice that we can share literature back and forth.
We have a special relationship now.
So this is a book that you could read on Independence Day?
Well, and this book is set in America. Like, the new version is in America. So if you... So see, we're celebrating America, and we're all friends. So I've brought us full circle.
And we're recording on the day of the vote. Whether or not they're going to leave the Brexit. So, you know, that seems appropriate.
And like every beauty queen ever, I really do want world peace.
The penalty that you had to pay for doing what you did was going last.
I love going last. I've never gone last
before.
Insider
knowledge, y'all. When you go last, that means you've disappointed Brian in some way.
Then my work here is done.
You have failed on the podcast.
I bet more people read my book than your book.
Oh!
Throw down!
Hey, guys!
What are we doing?
Hey, Jeremy!
Hey, Jeremy.
What do we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Well, maybe the library has it. Maybe the library doesn't, but either way, it's tickling our fancy.
My?
I do like when Mike says me.
Me?
That's my second favorite.
I do like shutting up myself. Mine actually kind of ties in with Jeremy's recommendation earlier and Amanda's future recommendation. It all kind of goes to, but anyway. So a lot has happened to be pop culture-wise last week, but little to really recommend. So today I thought I would talk about that gastropub I briefly hinted at a few months, weeks. I just remember Jeremy like doing some weird like
what?
Michael Jackson is equal to Prince explosion after the word
Don't
gastropub.
Bring it up, you're gonna traumatize gastropub.
Him. Pub.
Yeah. T.
It's called a restaurant. You
I didn't make up the term. One thing I really hate about going into bars solo is that the service is uniformly terrible. There have been times I've sat down next to a smelly dude at the bar, and by the time the bartender notices me, a spider has laid eggs in my new magnificent waist-length beard, and the smelly dude has become a bleached skeleton. Not so.
I love how pleased you were with that. That's great.
I enjoyed it so much, no one cared. That's the usual jokes that I lay down. The ones I'm like, and no one cares. Hilarious. The ones I actually think put time in. Not so at the Flying Saucer, a delicious gastropub close to the Frist downtown. Not only is the service great, but you can also get tasty dishes like a made-to-order personal pizza or a tapas-style dish called the Hungry Farmer, which features an assortment of meats and cheeses. There are 200-plus beers, most of which are on tap, with new ones added every day. And if you join their Beer Nerd program, Beer Canerd, it's misspelled. Great, guys. And drink 200 beers, you get a golden plate with your name on the wall. Oh, boy.
You get a special blue book that was written by someone without a name.
I need an achievement-based way to get to alcoholism. As of this recording, I'm up to 41 beers. Someday, guys, I'll join AA. But when that day comes,
Is
that in the Union Station Hotel?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it's right next door to the Frist. It's got a big sign.
I think I've seen the sign. That was why I was like,
it's very cool. Apparently, it's been there for like 17 years, but it's like tucked in this corner. You know? We got Bill.
Nothing like a little Elmer Bernstein doing the National Geographic thing.
Yeah.
And that's what I want to recommend, a DVD that we've just gotten in the library called Great Migration. This takes viewers around the world and on an arduous journey of millions of animals undertake to ensure the survival of their species. Great stuff. National Geographic always knocks it out of the ballpark. Highly recommend it. One more time, the title is Great Migrations. Jeremy.
We're doing a podcast, but I want to direct listeners to the radio. Radio. It's this thing that they used to have that people liked when there were batteries. And
they played four songs over and over and had annoying DJs.
If you had a plate in your head, you could pick up stuff. Well, I will typically listen to the news on the radio. I might put it on hippie radio if my kid wants to hear music and I don't have any music in the car. But now, if you're within a small radius in Nashville, you can tune in to 101.5 FM to hear WXNA, which is basically like the ghost of WRVU brought back to life. I was driving home last night and listening to the Hip-Billy Jamboree, and that's a great show that was on WRVU. They play old country music. It's fantastic. I heard Broad-Minded by the Leuven Brothers, where the hook is that word broad-minded is spelled S-I-N, and it talks about drinking and cheating.
Some people say they gamble now and then for pleasure and drink a little whiskey just to please a friend. They say it's really nothing, you've got to be broad-minded. That word in my Bible is spelled S-I-N. That word broad-minded is spelled
S-I-N. A friend of mine has a show on there on Thursday mornings that I probably won't ever get to listen to, except I could stream it at WXNAFM.org, and I plan to do that because I like hearing good music on the radio by people who care, not by robots. Speaking of robots,
I'm a heartless android. And also, Pat Johnson, who works in the public technology department here, has a show on Sunday nights.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
I'll splice in the name of it.
Tune in to Music Monarchs, where Patricio Johnson brings you the best of classic soul from the 1960s to now. That's Sunday nights at 9 p.m., only on 101.5 FM. WXNA Nashville. And that's another great non-segue for me.
I once asked a historian and librarian friend of mine if history was a humanity or science, and he said it was a humanity. And the answer surprised me a little bit, but I haven't forgotten it. But my friend's assertion that the study of history is a humanity has probably never rang more true to me than now as I read The Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman. So The Guns of August chronicles the diplomacy in the years before World War I and the first month of the war. That would be August 1914. It was a bestseller when it first came out in 1962. It won the Pulitzer Prize. Famously, President Kennedy gave copies to everyone in his cabinet and ordered them to read it. This is probably the most popular book ever written about World War I. I'm fascinated by World War I, but I've never read this book. I've read many other books on World War I. I mean, do you really need to read Gravity's Rainbow to understand contemporary fiction?
We've entered some parallel universe where Brian is reading a book that I own.
In the broadest, generalist terms, Tuchman's thesis is that World War I is Germany's fault, right? Now, that's what it says.
What the world?
That's what it says in the Treaty of Versailles, too. Okay. So most contemporary scholarship argues that that conclusion is somewhat lazy and reductionist. You know, I'm not really interested in lazy and reductionist interpretations.
So, I know I am.
So I've read a lot of histories of the war and books about America's involvement in the war and books about the literature of the war, especially Welsh poets. And I've played a lot of historical simulation board games about the war. But I'm finally getting around to reading The Guns of August. Now, here's what I learned reading this, is that this is a work of profound literary beauty. So she paints.
Does that mean hard to read?
I don't think so. No, I think you would love this book. It's really good. It's just so transcendently good. I think that anyone who has a brain could read it and love it.
I read the semi-prequel, The Proud Tower, which is quite good, which is like basically Europe from like 1890 up until 1914. It was really good.
The Library of America edition has The Proud Tower and The Guns of August together in one volume. So you paint insightful portraits of all the major players of the great powers. It's written so well. It's kind of like I feel like I'm reading War and Peace. Yeah, she's a masterful prose stylist. These days, like a lot of people, I'm living on a steady diet of, quote, internet content, unquote. And, the people that are writing said content, even if they could write it better, they don't have the time to and they don't get paid enough to care. But luckily, the Guns of August is operating in a totally different paradigm and my mind and heart are all the better for it. And I'm listening to the audio version read by Ian Stewart and my ear is all the better for this. It's like someone has just written this long form poem about my favorite subject. It's kind of amazing. It's 500 pages and I have tingles the whole way through. It's funny because I pretty much wanted to vomit when it first started. When I first started it, I didn't really care. It was this posh British voice narrating the story about crusty gentry who I know are going to cause more suffering than the world has ever known. And it was written in an ornate style that I knew also only leads to a letter C conservative interpretation of the war. I didn't care at first. Okay, but I kept on and I realized that I had waded not into a popular work of history, but an artistic triumph. Now, the Minority Report on Tuckman is that she gets history wrong. I'm not a scholar. As far as I know, she doesn't get anything wrong as much as she leaves things out for the sake of her narrative. Notoriously, she crafts the book in such a way that the war starts when Germany invaded Belgium. She just kind of ignores that the war actually started when Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia and then Russia declared war on
Austria-Hungary.
And then Germany invaded Belgium. She just kind of ignores the Eastern Front. Now, any school-aged child could look up in an encyclopedia how and when the war started, but that's not the story that she's telling. And I think a lot of male academics didn't like that suddenly someone else was all of a sudden the expert on World War I in the public's eye that wasn't them. Also, considering that she sold so many books and got so much praise, I think there's more than a little bit of envy and a heck of a lot of, well, actually... Now, I'm coming this from a somewhat privileged position because I've read a lot of other stuff about World War I. So as opposed to Guns of August being the only book I've ever read about it, which I think is true of the general public, I kind of know the stuff she left out. So it doesn't bother me as much, or maybe the fact that because I'm not a professional historian. But this in no way takes away from the intrinsic qualities of Tuckman's book, so much better than I ever thought it would be, The Guns of August.
She also wrote a really good book on the Zimmerman Telegram, if you ever get a chance to check that down. It's like 100 pages.
She writes the good, I cannot deny.
What's the Zimmerman Telegram?
That's where the Germans colluded with Mexico to, like, if Mexico declared war on the United States and got distracted and not entered the war, they would give them a piece of the United States, I believe. Yeah, it's one of those, like, you know, one of the few things that it's like, you know, a cause to join the war, even though she doesn't say it outright. She's like, you know, she kind of couches it in a, like, well, they didn't, like, this wasn't 100% why the United States joined the war, but it was definitely a factor.
She never actually says World War I is Germany's fault, but you get that impression. And now for something probably totally different.
A little different. Okay, people, so it's an election year, and everyone is worried about our future president. A lot of folks are not happy with what's happening in our country right now. But in order to fix the problem, a crazy musician in an alternate universe decides to bring back all of our former presidents from the dead so that they can make this country great again. Unfortunately, the dead presidents decide that the best way to do that is to destroy everything and rebuild from scratch. So that doesn't really work for those of us who are currently wanting not to die. So S.H.I.E.L.D., as in Agents of... decides not to use the Avengers because no one wants to see Captain America behead Harry Truman. Although it did make for a pretty good headline in the paper, as in Cap Snaps in Scrap, Decapted America Stars in Truman Show. Which I got a kick out of, and Mike apparently doesn't enjoy. So instead, they decide to use their favorite Merc with a Mouth because he's from Canada, naturally. Plus, he just, you know, likes to kill stuff. So thanks to my husband, I have now been sucked into the world of Deadpool. and I'm kind of coming late to the game, but that doesn't mean I'm not enjoying it as much. So Deadpool takes on the Dead Presidents in the graphic novel Dead Presidents.
As a president's nerd, it is a delight from beginning to end because he kills all of them.
My favorite part, Franklin Pierce, that they're having a meeting at one point and all the dead presidents are in the room and Jimmy Carter's and he's like, wait, I'm not dead.
Yeah.
that was funny. So Deadpool takes on the Dead Presidents in the first volume that was written by Brian Posehn and I think you say Jerry Duggan, with art by Tony Moore from 2013. Jeremy can correct me later because he's currently passed out in the corner. So Posehn is probably familiar to most people for his stand-up comedy or his character roles on comedies like The Big Bang Theory. Personally, I think that he and Deadpool are a pretty good match. Now, the library has a bunch of Deadpool graphic novels if you want more. You can check out our off-the-shelf blog on July 14th when I talk about what it's like when someone turns Deadpool loose in the library.
Oh, I was just going to say that the Posehn / Jerry Duggan ones are the best ones. I've tried many different Deadpool trades, mm-hmm. and they're not as good. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, some of them don't quite have that sarcastic edge that he has.
Probably helps whenever the person writing the comic book is a professional stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
So that's read the Deadpool with the Dead Presidents and have a good 4th of July.
Corrections are so funny. So, one correction. Jeremy used the wrong tense when plugging Pride Festival.
Oh, wow.
He spoke as if it already happened. Jeez, you let him host the show one time.
Power.
Okay.
He's got, a time travel device made of rainbows.
What I was suggesting was that Pride is all the time.
We missed out on an awesome Pride cast pun. That's my correction.
Okay. No more corrections, but one addendum.
Oh.
And that is the promo voice reading the ad copy that Mike plagiarized was not a razor-sharp Maria Bamford parody. It was the actual voiceover from the YouTube channel Zoom In Games, whose goal seems to be to reinforce every negative stereotype about video game culture. All right. For more information about how to be a good voice actor, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
Our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
You can subscribe to the PopMedic podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or via RSS. Next week, I think we're off next week. We just decided.
We did.
Yeah, we just decided.
Too much party.
We're going to be chugging Budweiser. And
you mean America.
Eating meat and then hating ourselves.
And then coming America. Back for physical fitness.
Yes, America. That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
So party
losing
now,
all
folks.
That weight we just gained.
Binge and purge.
Liberty or Death, The American Insurrection, the new volume, the fifth volume in the Co-In system, counterinsurgency, a system that manages to capture indeed the very complex, intricate topic of counterinsurgency as different from traditional military conflict, as an entanglement of political factors, economic factors, social factors, and unequal forces that are fighting against each other on a long span of time for overall control of a territory. Allow me to be abundantly clear from the very beginning of my conclusions. Liberty or Death is an excellent game. Simply excellent.
about Manic.